From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Military veterans are coming home to a bleak job market and often with skills that employers don't fully appreciate. Young veterans have double the unemployment rate of their non-military peers. Employers worry about PTSD, another tour. Their champions say, hire these people, they're great. This hour on Point after the sacrifice, finding jobs for American war vets. You can join the conversation, Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans. What have you seen in the job market? What reaction do you get from potential employers? Employers, are you hiring veterans? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Everybody's been talking about this lately. As troops come home from Iraq, many, many more will come home from Afghanistan, a million or two over the next few years. Stephen Colbert here asked the Army's Chief of Staff, Raymond Odierno, on December 14th to make the case for hiring veterans.
Sell employers on hiring veterans.
First off, I would say you get selfless service. You get somebody with integrity. You get somebody with high moral values. You get somebody with a work ethic. You get someone who is willing to sacrifice and put something before himself. And you get somebody who deserves the thankfulness of their country because they were willing to raise their right hand and defend our country.
Now, what... Yeah!
There's the applause. You hear the enthusiasm for it right there, but look at the numbers, and they can be pretty tough for returning veterans. Joining me first today from Washington is Andrew Tillman. He covers homecoming issues for the Military Times, which publishes the Army Times, Navy Times, Marine Corps Times, and Air Force Times. Andrew Tillman, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
We've seen a whole range of numbers out there. Overall veterans higher than the national average, maybe 11 or 12% compared to 9-something percent, let's say. For young veterans, maybe 30% we've seen for veterans between 20 and 24 years old, unemployed. For the youngest, I've seen for November anyway, almost 38% unemployment among that youngest tier of veterans. Those are tough numbers at the young end, Andrew.
Absolutely. That's exactly where the biggest problem is concentrated among the young men in particular. And the gap is growing. As you say, it's spent most of this year over 30%, and that's just been steadily climbing for the past several years as the economy struggled.
What's pushing or leading to this unemployment? We've got it right across the country, so it's not a surprise to Americans to hear about unemployment. But why would it be higher for returning veterans than for, let's say, young ones or any of them, than for others their age?
Well, there's a lot of reasons. I mean, first off, you have a lot of returning veterans with some real problems. I mean, the military estimates that 1 in 5 people coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan have a diagnosed traumatic brain injury. So, I mean, clearly that's... That kind of a disability is going to be a problem when finding a job. And then also there's some economic issues underlying that. Veterans, more than other people, are likely to go into local, city, county, and state jobs, and those jobs have been hit much harder during this recession and budget crunch.
So there they are. They're bringing home some baggage with them, but they're also bringing home strengths. Describe those. We just heard General Odierno begin to go into that quarter, but what about the positives coming out of the military environment into civilian employment?
Yeah, I think that the veterans come out with a strong work ethic, as General Odierno said. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are drug free because the military requires that and tests for it. A lot of them are just used to working very long hours. I know that some of the active duty troops I spend time with, it's totally common for them to work 12 and 14 hour days, and they don't really complain about it. So I think that that's a key element that that many employers would look to. And then in some cases there's some very specific training, whether it be in the medical field or logistics field, that troops can bring some specific training as well.
You talk with soldiers who have, and sailors and all who have come back. What's it like for them to suddenly be tossed out of the order and structure of military life into looking for a job in this civilian environment, in this civilian economy today?
Well, I think it's really jarring for a lot of them for a variety of reasons. I mean, one, the military and the all-volunteer force these days is really kind of isolated from the civilian world and the civilian economy. So these guys go and they spend 4 years at Fort Hood in Texas or Fort Bragg in North Carolina, something like that. And then they go back to their hometowns maybe and they really don't have the social connections that a lot of people rely on to get a job. And I think that there's another interesting facet that I think the military's really tried to talk to separating veterans about, and that's just the language they use. You know, a lot of active duty troops speak in a very complex jargon, and civilians just don't understand it. I mean, if a guy comes in to an employer and says, you know, good morning, sir. My MOS was 11 Bravo, and I was promoted to E5, and I'd be happy to show you my DD-214. You know, a lot of employers are going to have no idea what this guy's talking about, even if the translation of that might be something that's compelling and would, you know, encourage the guy to be hired.
Absolutely. It's interesting. We're going to look at the history of Americans coming home from war. It's frequently not been an easy transition. This is not the first time that we've seen some difficulties there, but those returning vets may be dealing with fewer employer veterans than ever before. In the all-volunteer era of the forces, the chances are the people who might hire them have never been in the military, Andrew.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, you get into this issue of the all-volunteer force being increasingly separate from the civilian economy, and a lot of the civilian employers just don't know what these guys have been through. And, you know, there's some concern that there might be some bias, intended or not intended. You know, a lot of employers might be concerned with all this talk about post-traumatic stress that any guy coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, regardless of his work ethic, might be, you know, on the verge of some kind of, you know, lashing out with some kind of post-traumatic rage. And I don't think that's true at all, but that might be the perception out there.
What about policy now? We saw just last month that President Obama signed legislation with big tax credits for businesses that hired unemployed and disabled veterans. We see the federal government itself hiring the highest percentage of veterans in more than two decades in the last fiscal year. I don't know about education offerings, the GI Bill equivalents and so on that are offered today. Policy-wise, in terms of what can be done from that end of things, are we up to snuff these days? Are we offering good assistance and incentives?
Yeah, I think there's been a big push on the side of the federal government, and certainly the president and the first lady have talked about this a lot over the past year. And I think that there's been some talk in the private sector as well, some large companies promising to hire a lot of veterans. And this is a huge concern for the Defense Department and Veterans Affairs. I think one of the problems is that the DOD and the VA have this very elaborate patchwork of different programs to help veterans, and they're all very different and kind of uncoordinated. And I think there's a real push right now to try to do some research and figure out empirically, you know, what is effective at addressing this problem, and try to narrow down some of the various efforts going on.
Out of the military, out of Iraq, out of Afghanistan, and into this employment economy can be tricky. Andrew Tillman, please stand by with the Military Times there in Washington. I want to go right now to Hilliard, Ohio. Joining us is Daniel Hutchinson. He served 5 years in the U.S. Army, served as a medic in Iraq in 06, 07, left the military in 2010. He's founder of Ohio Combat Veterans, which helps Ohio veterans return to civilian life. Daniel Hutchinson, thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me, Tom.
What are you seeing out there? What's it like for vets coming back and trying to find that job they need?
I'm seeing a shell shock. They're not only having problems finding employment, but just dealing with everything that they've seen in Iraq. You know, unemployment is high across the board, and I think for veterans, it's even harder because a lot of them are having problems trying to translate their job skills in a way that civilian employers understand, kind of like Andrew said.
You say shell shock, and what do you mean? Do you mean because of what they saw, or just the re-entry kind of transition that anybody goes through, kind of culture shock of coming back from military to civilian life, Daniel?
It's the re-entry transition. We live such a structured lifestyle in the military. We know where we're staying at night. We know when we're eating. We know that we're getting a paycheck. All of those things are guaranteed, and then when you let go of military service, you kind of have to really figure all that stuff out on your own, and I think that's kind of overwhelming for a lot of our veterans.
Do they get help in doing that, Daniel? Do you see help on the ground?
I don't. I see very little help. There are the traditional avenues like the VA and whatnot. But to be honest with you, a lot of our veterans feel that the VA is just not fulfilling their promise.
Andrew, what about reentry programs? What's out there?
Well, the military has some transition programs for veterans that are planning on separating, but they go through these programs in the several months before they actually separate. And then the VA has a variety of different support networks. But I think Daniel's right. I mean, there is the sense out there that a lot of the VA programs are kind of too little, too late, and are not really effective at addressing the real scope of the problem.
So where do you see, Daniel, returning vets first looking? What's their instinct when they come back and they say, I need a job? Are there general directions they tend to go in?
I think with their muscle memory and what's programmed into them when they're in the military is their first instinct is to go to the VA and try to get assistance from there. And, you know, maybe that'll work for them, maybe not. If it doesn't work for them, I see them going to a lot of the local, you know, the state resource centers and whatnot.
Do you think we're doing right by our veterans from these wars, Daniel?
I don't. I think we are failing our veterans. I think we're failing them in a big way. It's really disappointing when veterans come in and they spend the last 4, 8, 10 years, whatever the case may be, in the military, and they serve in combat, and then they come home and they can't even get a job and they can't even put food on their table.
Andrew Tillman, can we serve them correctly? Can we do right by them with this economy? Do we have to solve the whole economic problem to solve the unemployment problem among Iraq and Afghanistan war vets?
I think there may be some truth to that. You know, these guys are hit harder than everyone else because they don't have the social contacts, and the state and local government budgets have been cut, and it's a real problem.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking today about American war veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan coming home to no jobs, talking about finding jobs for the newest generation of American war vets. President Obama talking about this, announced several measures at the White House in November to help veterans find work, including new tax incentives for businesses that hire veterans.
If you can save a life on the battlefield, then you can save a life in an ambulance. If you can oversee a convoy or millions of dollars of assets in Iraq, you can help a business back home manage their supply chain or balance their books. If you can juggle the demands of raising a family while a loved one is at war, you can juggle the demands of almost any job in America.
There's the president speaking up for jobs for veterans. He's done that a lot in recent days. Daniel Hutchinson is with us from Hilliard, Ohio, founder of Ohio Combat Veterans, Iraq War vet himself, 29 years old. Andrew Tillman is with us, senior writer for the Military Times, covering all kinds of homecoming issues. Let's get a caller right here from Nashville. Michael's calling. Hello, Michael. You are on the air.
Hello. How are you?
Hi. Good. Very well. What's your story, Michael?
Hey, I am a veteran of the Afghan War. I'm still in the Army now.
Okay.
I'm in the Nashville, Tennessee area, and I'm looking into potentially getting out of the Army if I want, but as I'm looking into things, I'm seeing that really it's best for me to stay in because I feel that there's two factors contributing to the unemployment rate that the soldiers have. The first is that the soldiers, because they have such a very regimented, they're told exactly what to do lifestyle, that when it comes to looking for a job in this kind of amorphous job market, they really don't know how to relate or to look for something in this. Something is not as structured. That's kind of contributing to the unemployment rate, I feel.
Do you feel that in yourself, Michael? Are you afraid to leave the military because you're concerned about, you know, dealing with that less structured civilian employment world and a tough world indeed?
Actually, I'm not, because I joined the Army a few years after I graduated from college. I have some real world, some private sector experience, I should say, and that has helped me to know how to do some job hunting. So a lot of these guys who went straight into the military after they went out of high school or college, that's kind of been a contributing factor, I think, to their not being able to relate.
Michael, I appreciate your call, and we've got that perspective. We've got all kinds of response here online. Here's Rob saying, I have a military surplus store and a recycling plant. I hope to hire 200 vets. You know, he says, come on down, and leaves his web address there. Look at onpointradio.com in the comments. Maybe there's something there for you. Here's vets from a different era. This is KB, says, in 1987, I got out of the Army after 3 years to a minimum wage job after I was responsible for the health of 18,000 soldiers. Why is it any different now? I guess she's saying, Daniel Hutchinson, you know, she had a lot of responsibility in the military. She came out and took a minimum wage job and has built her life and career up from there. Do you find vets willing to do the same today, Daniel?
Absolutely. One, I can relate with her because I was a medic in Iraq. And overseas, you know, I was there during the troop surge of 2007. I did everything from running IVs to sewing up wounded soldiers. But when I got back, at best, I could get a job making $8 an hour, taking vital signs and putting on Band-Aids just because the medical certifications didn't carry over. But as far as with the veterans that I'm seeing today, yeah, I'm seeing veterans that have served in the invasion of Fallujah, you know, working, changing oil for minimum wage, and that's very disappointing.
What's your best advice from what you've seen, Daniel? What do you advise people who come to you and say, I'm back, what should I do?
Number one, I tell them to hit unemployment. That's a resource that they have absolutely earned. And then what I work on next is helping them work on the resume. Like I think Andrew said earlier, a lot of these veterans are having problems putting their military skills in a way that civilian employers can understand it.
Daniel Hutchinson with Ohio Combat Veterans joining us from Hilliard, Ohio. Daniel, good luck to you and everybody you're working with. Thanks for being with us today.
All right. Thank you so much, Tom.
Let's bring another veteran right in here. Rai Barcott joins us from Charlotte, North Carolina, served from 01 to 06 as a captain in the Marine Corps, deployed in Bosnia, Horn of Africa, Iraq, author of It Happened on the Way to War, A Marine's Path to Peace, about a group he founded in Kibera, Kenya, to do some great work there. But he's back in the States now, paying a lot of attention to what's going on with American vets. This generation, been writing in the Harvard Business Review blog about skills veterans can bring to the workplace. Rai Barcott, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be here.
You know, there is some skepticism out there. Here's all from our website. Jason writes, look, this is not a knock on soldiers, but some of them don't really have the skills that bring immediate value to employers. And employers cannot afford to be nice guys who can carry an employer while he learns the ropes. What do you say to that perspective, Rai?
Well, I say it's a reflection of the problems that we face in our larger economy. We're so short-term focused that we're not making long-term investments. I mean, I transitioned from the military to the business world. I work at a company now called Duke Energy.
Yep.
And the fact is, a lot of our public companies are sitting on cash. They're trying to ride out, trying to figure out what's coming up next in the economy. They're not taking the long view, and the long view is to invest in the training of a young, capable workforce. You're not going to get the immediate skills to match into the job. It's going to take a few months to train up a workforce that can perform specialized tasks, particularly for our young vets who have not graduated from college. But it is a long-term investment, and it'll pay off, just as General Odierno mentioned to Stephen Colbert kicking it off. I mean, these are long-term skills that you need to be successful in any walk of life, I believe. Integrity, commitment, discipline, the ability to work as a team. Funny thing happened for me. We started the program off, Andrew, talking about the language gap mm-hmm. between the two sectors, military and private sector, and that is absolutely the case. And Daniel mentioned it on working with vets on their resumes to cut out the military jargon. But there's something else there too. There's a disconnect between values, I felt this most forcefully when I was first interviewing for a job out of business school, and I came into this one particular interviewer, and he was a good guy. He didn't mean me wrong, but he threw his feet up on the table and he said, the first thing he said was, sell yourself. And I'm sitting there. I mean, I was shell shocked. I didn't know
what's happening. He's got his feet on the table. And
nobody would ever ask me that in the military. That's not why. You know, that's not why I'm here. I'm here to make a bigger impact about things that matter. And so there's, you know, that's a part of the values that exist within the private sector. You have to focus on the bottom line of an organization and make money and pursue enlightened self-interest, but that really has to be balanced with a deeper sense of purpose. And vets in particular, I certainly wrestled with this, have a really tough time of you know, putting themselves out there, selling themselves. And so that's another piece of advice that I often mention to folks that are in the hiring business and looking to hire vets. Sometimes, you know, you've got to reach out. And you reach out and have a deeper conversation, and you'll see some of those values that can really carry an organization over the long term.
Sell yourself, absolutely, sort of every day and ordinary in the civilian world, but maybe not the way things work every day in the military. Rye, Andrew, stand by. We've got a lot of callers here. Steve in Winooski, Vermont. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi. I think a question that's not being asked is what brought them in to begin with. Because a lot of people went in, I mean, I get this from people I've met, they went in because they couldn't find work. Now, the economic climate has gotten much worse since they went in. It gets worse every day, I think. So why expect them to find jobs when everybody else can't find jobs? They aren't there.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Andrew Tillman, I mean, you clearly some portion of people do go into the military because they can't find work in the first place. Many go in young, maybe straight out of high school. That doesn't put them in an advantageous position. So maybe these unemployment figures are high for a reason that civilians would understand pretty darn well.
I think the caller is absolutely right. You know, I mean, the military positions its recruiting stations in some cases in places where there's not a lot of civilian jobs because they know that the likelihood of them getting young 18 and 19-year-olds to sign on. And that's particularly true considering the fact that in 05 and 06 and 07, the military, particularly the Army and the Marine Corps, had a real recruiting problem. So they really had to lean on some of these places that were already hit hard by the economy. So when these guys are doing their 4 years and now getting out and returning to those places, there's still no jobs there, just like there was when they signed up. So the caller's absolutely right. I mean, there's a real long-term issue underlying this as well.
Right, Barcott, you know, if you go in without a college degree and you come out without that degree, you know, these days, everybody has heard it a million times. You've got to have more education to get the job. Is military time and service a substitute for that? Do employers look at it that way or not?
I need to push back here because I fundamentally disagree. I don't think I have not met a Marine. I've not met a single Marine who enlisted, who said he enlisted because he was looking for a job, couldn't find a job. All, I mean, and I think that's true across our services. What's attractive to the service is the sense of mission, the sense of purpose. And sure, it pays the bills, but almost all the young vets that I know go in for a higher calling. A lot of them are coming back to these areas, and Andrew's got a very accurate point that a lot of the recruiting's happening in rural areas and parts of the United States that are particularly economically depressed and really struggling to find places to get jobs. But I think that, you know, we have a very strong GI Bill. There are larger opportunities for veterans to qualify to get an additional education. But those that are not in that position to do so, we ought to be able to have our American companies in a position to hire specialized labor that doesn't necessarily need a college degree.
Some companies doing that. I mean, JPMorgan Chase, Verizon, both signed a pledge to hire a total of 100,000 veterans by 2020. But others absolutely not doing that. And some employment training people quoted here recently, there's a quote from the New York Times about the training. They say, well, if you train someone to be a sniper, that's not necessarily a skill that's transferable. Of course, there's many other skills. And even that, if you look at the discipline behind it, there's just a posture that could be valuable. Mike in Omaha, Nebraska. Mike, you're on the air.
Hey there. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Mike.
Yes. I have a couple of things to say. One is I'm a teacher at the college level, and I meet veterans all the time, and I will tell you to sell the veterans, nobody applies themselves harder to anything that they're trying to do than the veterans. They're the best students I ever have. Okay.
Yep, we hear you.
The second is, you know, they might not be a sniper, might not have, you know, direct translation into the workforce. However, that person is seriously trainable. And if the government were to invest the money into infrastructure and have the people that they can train to install and to do all the necessary hard engineering, I guess, you know, you have a workforce there that can actually continue to serve the country, which they love to do, and, you know, do it for the good, for the common good.
Mike, we've got it. I appreciate your call. We're talking about returning vets and the jobs they're finding and not finding. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I mean, Rye Barcott, there's a point about the economy generally. I mean, there are so many Americans out of work. These vets without jobs are hardly alone, though their numbers in many cases are, the unemployment numbers are higher. But the caller says, you know, this is a reason for the government to invest in infrastructure, put a lot of people back to work, including vets. What about overall national economic policy? These people went and fought for the country. Is the country there for them, for its own citizens here, right?
Well, I really commend the efforts of President Obama, and I think it's one of the few issues where we've really seen a lot of support across aisles and not locked into this nonsensical bickering that we're seeing in our Capitol. There are a lot of jobs that are needed that do not necessarily require college degrees. Now, I'll give you an example from the company I'm at now at Duke Energy, which is a large utility company. You know, there's a shortage in this country of welders. Half of our company's workforce is eligible for retirement in the next 7 years. Half of it.
Okay.
So you have these huge demographic shifts that are happening, and really, I think a smart company's position on this should be take the long view, invest in some of these young vets. It's going to pay off 2-3 years down the road. You might not be able to immediately turn it to work in the next quarter, but it's a long-term bet.
A lot of people care about this. We've got Governor Buddy Romer, a former Louisiana governor who's now running for the GOP presidential nomination. He's tweeting in response to our show on the air right now. We've got to do something about this. Julia in Brighton, Massachusetts. Julia, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. So a deeper problem is vets who do have usable skills may have those masked if their interpersonal skills are in trouble because they've been traumatized. So they may not know how to match with an employer and sell themselves to an employer if their trauma is causing them, their own emotions, to hijack their thinking. And you can the military applies cognitive behavioral therapies to help vets readjust.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is they're addressing up the problem at the level of thinking. And the problem is actually at a visceral feeling, adrenaline level. So it needs a therapy that enters at the heart level,
mm-hmm.
at the level of the guts.
Mm-hmm.
And those therapies exist, and many of them are in research and are showing wonderful results. And that's where research money needs to go to help these men get to the point where they can think clearly, these men and women.
Julie, I appreciate your call. Rye, what about that? I mean, we've seen plenty of reports of some employers feeling reluctance. Oh, my gosh, they've been in a war zone. You know, are they going to be wound too tight? That kind of perspective. What do you say, Rye? And how to get around it?
Well, that's the real hidden side behind all the worthy attention behind post-traumatic stress, which has resulted in an environment that is far more hospitable to veterans returning. A lot of vets getting the care that they need, as opposed to earlier generations, such as my father, who fought in Vietnam and came back and has lived with those effects untreated for many, many years, which I wrote about to a certain extent. I think we started off the show by mentioning that about 1 in 5 vets are facing traumatic brain injuries, and that's a very significant portion. But we should recognize that there are a lot of vets. That's not an excuse to bring somebody on board. And there are a lot of vets that are getting treatment. They're turning the page, and we need to invest in them now.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about American war vets from Iraq and Afghanistan coming home to no jobs, not enough jobs, very high levels of unemployment there. Worst among the youngest vets. Rye Barcott served and is home, and he's doing well. He's got a job. He's talking a lot about veterans. He's blogging about their issues at the Harvard Business Review blog. He's with us from Charlotte, North Carolina today. Andrew Tillman is here, senior writer for the Military Times, joining us from Washington. I want to get a little historical perspective here right now, if we can, because there have been a lot of wars, and we think, well, how are we treating our vets now compared to back in the day? Thomas Childers joins us right now from Philadelphia, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, author of Soldier from the War Returning, The Greatest Generation's Troubled Homecoming from World War II. Thomas Childers, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I think a lot of Americans look back and imagine that the greatest generation, as Tom Brokaw dubbed them, coming home from World War II, got treated pretty darn well and had a good homecoming experience, the GI Bill and all the rest. Look back on that history. Help us do a little compare and contrast here, Thomas. What was the experience of that huge generation of World War II returning vets?
Well, I think we have this view. Brokaw's not the only one, of course, but he's the most obviously the most well-known. But this view that these guys came home healthy, happy, well-adjusted, a grateful nation welcomed them with open arms, but that was not the case. Listening to the conversation this morning, one understands, I mean, it's the same set of problems. It doesn't matter whether it's good war, bad war, just war, necessary war. The problems of veterans coming home remain the same. At the end of the Second World War, there was veterans had a huge problem with homelessness. They didn't call it that, but that's certainly what it was. High unemployment. Veterans, the rate unemployment rate for veterans was triple that for civilians all the way into 1948.
Wow.
For disabled veterans, it was infinitely worse. In January of 1946, more than 52,000 disabled veterans who'd completed the military's rehabilitation and occupational therapy programs applied for jobs, and 6,000 got them. Psychological problems. 1.3 million servicemen experienced some sort of what were called psychoneurotic disorders during the Second World War. In 1945, there were 10,000 men, it was overwhelmingly men, were reporting and were treated for these psychoneurotic disorders, and the numbers rose in 46 and 47. In fact, in 1947, roughly half the beds in VA hospitals were occupied by men suffering from what we would call post-traumatic stress disorder. And that was just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, it's a problem now as it was then, which is that many veterans who certainly suffer from this condition don't seek medical treatment, depend on family, church, community, and so on. That's good, but often need medical help beyond that, and they don't get it. Nobody wants to have, nobody at the end of the Second World War wanted to have neuropsychiatric stamped on their papers.
Yeah, sure. So you're talking about homelessness and unemployment being big problems even after World War II, and that's when it was not an all-volunteer army. I mean, everybody from across all social strata had, many had served and been drafted and volunteered and the whole gamut. Was there a debate in those years about when a much bigger portion of the population was invested in this about how we were treating returning vets, Thomas Childers?
Oh, absolutely. In 1945, before the war ended, there was already the anticipation of problems that veterans were going to face. Magazines, self-help books were written. The government produced handbooks of all sorts of with all sorts of advice on everything from job training to what was demurely called marital relations. So there was a great deal of worry. There was an article in the Boston Herald, the headline for which was, will your son be a killer when he comes home?
Oh,
the sort of sense that, you know, these men who'd been exposed to the brutalities of war would come home and really wouldn't be able to fit into civilian society. And what were we going to do about it?
How did it ultimately happen then that we think of the GI Bill and that generation as, you know, having come back, gone off to college on the GI Bill, developed all kinds of professional skills that really carried the great sort of American century decades of our, industrial hegemony? How did that come to be the understanding of what had happened there? Or is that what actually evolved after time?
Well, after a time it did. I mean, certainly the GI Bill was enormously helpful. Probably one of the biggest pieces of social legislation in American history, it did all of the things you just described. On the other hand, I mean, that story has been told and retold. We've heard it in volume. But there's this other side of it. And if you look at the period itself, 45, 6, 7, 8, 9, it was everywhere. It was in the magazines. It was the novels written. A lot of the film noir movies had dealt with the troubled veteran and so on. So this underside was always there. And, you know, you had 16 million veterans coming back from the war. One of the things that it did was it led to the unemployment, the psychological problems, the homelessness. There was what was called a divorce boom. We think about the baby boom.
Yeah.
But in 1946, 1947, it was the highest divorce rate in American history.
Wow. Do you have a sense that on balance we're doing better or worse now with our returning troops or veterans, Professor Childers?
I think it's a mixed bag. There are programs in place, more extensive programs in place, that the military offers to help veterans. But I think the same issues are still there. They're still problematic. There is no easy transition. Some people hit the ground, running and barely look back. But many, many, many have adjustment difficulties. And I think what I would say is that the societal understanding of this, you know, for a long time, there was all the discussion about Vietnam veterans, and the notion seemed to be that bad war, bad outcome, bad after effects, that somehow post-traumatic stress disorder, substance abuse, divorce, and so on, were unique products of the Vietnam experience, when in fact they are simply the outcome of war.
You want a war? Here's what you're going to have to deal with, very likely. Thomas Childers, Ray Barcott, Andrew Tillman, please stand by. A lot of listeners waiting to come in here. Jake in Brandenburg, Kentucky. Jake, welcome. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
I'm okay. What's your story, Jake?
Well, I was in the Army, and I got out for about 2 months and spent some time with my family. And, I'd been deployed about 3 times to Iraq. And the employer I went to, the first one, he said when he saw I had took a two-month hiatus, or whatever you want to call it.
Yes.
He said it looked like it was laziness to him, you know? So I figured.
You're kidding me. 2 months after three tours in Iraq, and he thought you were lazy?
That's what he said, yeah. It's all I could do to keep him jumping across the table and jerking a knot in his tail, you know? I didn't know how to take it, you know? And I finally, you know, being a truck driver in the military, you know, I hauled heavy equipment. I mean, I hauled it.
Yeah.
And then finally, nobody would hire me because I didn't have enough over the road experience, you know. And that's
you'd been over all the roads of Iraq. How did it ultimately turn out for you, Jake, or how has it?
Well, finally, I found somebody that did hire me, and then my GI Bill didn't really pan out like I wanted it to because it only paid about 1 month of monthly payment, one installment, instead of paying off the whole tuition.
Gosh!
But finally, somebody hired me, gave me some experience, and I got a great job now driving trucks. So it turned out pretty good.
Jake, I'm glad you worked it out, and I think you well deserve a couple of months before diving into all that. But I'm glad it worked out for you finally, Jake. Thanks for calling us today. Let's go to Brenda. Thank you, Jake. Brenda in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Brenda, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm commenting about statements that was made earlier by a veteran talking about the VA system and how they felt that the VA was ill-prepared to assist them once they were released from military duty.
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
I hate to say this, but I'm a veteran, and I'm also a VA employee, and I tend to agree with that particular veteran because they do have a lot of employees that are in positions that make the veterans very uncomfortable, you know, when they come back.
Why is that, Brenda? I mean, aren't they there to serve the veterans? Isn't that their job?
I believe that's their job, yes. But, you know, within the system itself, they tend to promote people that are ill-equipped or people that are not sensitive enough to the needs of these returning veterans, and that's male and female. I've worked with veterans myself that have applied for service-connected disabilities, and they're being denied on a regular basis. I've seen veterans that have been diagnosed, let's say, by a practitioner as being severely disabled with a mental health diagnosis, And when they apply for these claims and it goes to the VA regional office, these claims are rejected. A lot of these symptoms do not occur until the veterans return home. They might have been seen in the military, let's say, for depression, and at that particular time it might have been, maybe they didn't diagnose it, they might have said nonspecific.
Yeah.
And then when they go to the VA to try to get treatment, they give them a diagnosis, let's say, of schizoaffective disorder or whatever, and they go and apply for compensation for this particular disability, and they're denied. So they're being denied on a constant basis for the type of disabilities that they may have occurred, that may have occurred while they were on active duty. And it could be a mental health as well as a physical disability.
And you're watching that, Brenda, from within the VA system as a veteran, but who's also now an employee there. That must be hard to see. We're looking at veterans coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan and having trouble finding jobs, thinking about how to help them find jobs. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thomas Childers, you hear Brenda, she's inside the system, and she's describing a kind of grudging quality to the help that's given, an inconsistent quality. What about that compared to the post-World War II period?
Same thing. It's exactly the same. Veterans' complaints about the VA at the end of the Second World War were extensive. Too much red tape, having to argue about what benefits they were eligible for, inadequate medical facilities, and so on. It's very, very similar. I mean, it's an echo that one heard it after 1945.
Same thing, as if we don't really want to bear the costs of war. I guess that's obvious. Aaron in Brookline, Massachusetts. Aaron, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you, Tom?
I'm okay. What's your story, Aaron?
Well, I'm a reservist. I'm not a combat veteran. I'm in the Coast Guard, and I served during 9/11, as well as was recently deployed to the oil spill. And which I guess for us is our combat, if you will.
Yes.
And I have found a certain amount of frustration in the Boston area. I've been trying to get different jobs. And I have found that when, for example, at a sporting goods store, and also I have my CNA license, I was unable to get jobs because when people would find out that I was a reservist, they didn't want to hire me.
Because they were afraid you might be called up for duty.
That would be one thing, but I think also when they would look at my resume, they would see that I had, I'm not exactly sure why. I know that I certainly have a friend who's a headhunter who had once told me that I was not very smart to put the fact that I was in the military on the resume. And I know that in the case of the sporting goods store that I tried to get the job at, I ended up complaining to my command, who sent me to the EAP, which is the organization that provides support for veterans that are, reservists that are discriminated against. And it turns out that they don't come in and help you out. They just send you the information to give to a lawyer so that you can sue for a job that you otherwise feel that you should have gotten.
Boy, I mean, the idea that if you'd apply to a sporting goods store and you might be looked down on because of military experience, it's kind of mind-bending. Aaron, our time is short, but let me take that one to Rye Barcott. I mean, Rye, I'm looking at a recent report here. They're quoting Ted DeWalt with VetJobs.com in Georgia, saying nearly 65% to 70% of employers will not now hire National Guard and Reserve because they're afraid of people disappearing for months at a time. What about that, Ry?
Yeah, it's. I mean, this is talk about the failure of American industry right here. I mean, we have got to be able to figure out a way to make this work. We've got to make it work for business, and we got to make it work on the government side. You would think that would be able to figure out a way to put the right incentives in place so that veterans aren't faced with such circumstances.
With that, let me put this perspective to you. This is from Dan online, and a lot of some listeners may feel this. Many are very supportive, but here's one from Dan. Why should they, veterans, get special treatment for jobs? They had a job until recently. We've been out here for 3 years now struggling to get by with no end in sight for employment opportunities. What about that question, Ry? Why should vets get
I'm really glad you asked, because I think as we listen to the the course of the show, there's a tendency to think, well, this is a matter of charity. We gotta help these guys out because they're hurting and they can't do it themselves. And I think it's the wrong way to view it. Veterans have made a service to their country, but they also are coming back with incredible skills, skills for the long term, and that's the enlightened self-interest. That's why it is good for businesses to be a part of this and to engage our young men and women coming back. And on a national policy front, we need to figure out ways to make sure that that we're supporting those good decisions in the private sector.
Thomas Childers, another historical perspective here, maybe. I think it was George Washington himself who said, be careful how you treat your war veterans if you want them to show up the next time the country needs to be defended. What about that, Thomas Childers?
Well, I think it's obviously a very wise comment. I think one of the problems that's been talked about at various points by different callers and also the people on the panel here today is that we're talking that this mainstream society is so divorced from the experience of the military. We've had a lot of talk about the 1% and the 99% recently, but if you're talking about the military, it's 0.5%, 0.125% who have carried this burden, and very little understanding. I teach at the University of Pennsylvania, and you know, there are no veterans, none that I've encountered in the university. Somehow this gap between those who are serving and those who are being served needs to be narrowed. And I just wanted to underscore something that Rye said.
Quickly.
It isn't a matter of charity. It's a matter of people who are trained and bring skills and bring qualities to the business world that need to be appreciated.
Let's put them to work. Thomas Childers, University of Pennsylvania, Rye Barcott, It Happened on the Way to War, and Andrew Tillman with the Military Times. Thanks to each of you. This is On Point.